Jenny laughed.
Yes, and ongoing science quite often gives hints to make sure science goes the right way. But we do have to be careful about sending history wrong. We can't have all of it going unstable, agreed Ramona. The voyage lasted nearly an hour. Jenny and Ramona pointed out interesting farms, or said things like, "You get an even better view of the city from here," as new domes and towers came into sight at new bends of the river. Vivian saw endless hills from all sorts of different angles. It was like the Tor. The only difference was that the Noman Tower was not at all like a church. It was more like an old, old lighthouse. About the time Sam finished Jonathan's belt, and Jonathan buckled it back on, Jenny and Ramona turned and pointed the way the boat was going. "We're nearly down at the locks now. Can you see the Land's Ending?" About a field away, the green country just stopped. The blue sky came right down to the ground there.
"Ooh," said Vivian. "That looks a bit creepy."
"No, it's not," said Jonathan. "It's safe. The thing I hate about history is the way the ground goes on and on. If I had to live in history, that would send me mad in the first week." Vivian thought of the way Jonathan had become so uncomfortable while they were looking for Cousin Marty's house. This must have been the reason.
"Don't be silly, Jonathan," said Jenny. "No one's going to send you out into history."
Shortly, the boat turned a corner and nuzzled into a side channel of the river. There were high stone walls on either side. The boat drew into a wharf behind a line of others.
"You still wish to retain me?" it asked in its rattling voice.
"Yes, I said all day hire,"
Jenny said, as they stood up to get off.
"I wish they'd make those things a bit more trusting," she said to Ramona,
while they were climbing steps up the side of the wharf.
"It may be faulty,"
Ramona suggested. But when they looked back, the boat's roof was back in place with the word "hired" shining in big letters across the roof.
"It was just making sure we hadn't changed our minds," Ramona said.
At the top of the steps, they came to a kind of stone platform, right at the very end of the land. There was a long row of silvery booths at the back of the platform, in a line against the sky. Their doors were sliding open and shut as people came through in all sorts of costumes. Some of them looked businesslike, but most of them stopped and stared round them excitedly and pointed to the strange dress of the others. After that, they went and showed long golden tickets at a kiosk in the centre of the platform, where they were given maps and a crackling sheet of information, and directed to the other side of the platform, where a man stood at a gate checking tickets. The platform rang with excited exclamations and happy laughter, and the few people going the other way, mostly in Time City pyjamas, had to push their way through the slow throng in order to get to the booths. Jenny and Ramona led the way to the railing by the gate, where they leant and looked down at a huge tourist boat waiting to take people to the city. Colourful people were going down the long ramp, taking their seats aboard. There was another boat waiting across the river, where there were the same sort of platform and another row of booths. In between, stretching right across the river, were six really massive time locks, standing high against the sky above the platforms. As they watched, another big barge came slowly nudging through the third lock along, against the strong brown current of the River Tyne.
"Where does the river go to?"
Vivian asked.
"It runs through the locks, into different rivers at various times," Jenny said.
The tourist boat across the river was full. It clanged a bell and set out in a swirl of brown water on its journey to the city.
Music was playing on board, and people were opening bottles. It looked very festive.
"I'm thirsty,"
said Sam.
"Thirsty,"
he added loudly. And when nobody noticed, he went on saying it.
"What happens," Vivian asked, "if a tourist meets his own grandchildren and hates them and decides not to get married? Wouldn't that change history?"
"There's a whole branch of time patrol checking to make sure that won't happen," said Ramona.
"Hush, Sam."
"But quite a lot of people come here specially to meet their ancestors or their descendants," Jenny said. "We have conference rooms in Millennium where they can get together."
"I do think," Ramona said, "that Viv and Inga should have told Vivian more about Time City. It's not fair on the child."
She meant this to be covered up by the noise from all round, and by Sam's shouts of "thirsty." But Sam's voice dropped to a mutter just then, and Vivian heard her clearly. She was forced to invent some reason for her ignorance.
"They didn't trust me not to say anything at school," she said. "I mean, that would spoil history, wouldn't it? Does it matter much?"
"Yes, it does,"
Ramona said, looking very uncomfortable.
"If your general knowledge isn't good enough when you come to the leavers' tests at school, you'll be sent away to live in history, even though you are a Lee."
"Nobody stays in Time City by right, Vivian," Jenny explained. "We all have to earn our place. And there's a lot of competition from the students. Most of the young people studying continuum are hoping for jobs in the city when they finish." Jonathan swung away from the rail and stalked off. Vivian could see he was upset by this. But next moment he was back.
"I say, look at all these."
They turned round to find the platform full of frantic people, all coming from nowhere. A few did seem to be coming up the steps from the wharf, and one or two came swarming over the edge of the platform, but most of them were just there out of nowhere. They all went rushing towards the line of time locks. There, some of them vanished into silvery doors or opened silvery spaces, but most of them beat at the booths in a panic as if they were trying to get the doors open. This looked very odd when the door they were beating on happened to be open already. They were coming across the platform in waves, and later waves were running through earlier ones. The platform was suddenly a melting, rushing tumble of running figures and waving arms. They were in all sorts of clothes, but the greatest number were in Time City pyjamas.
"Time ghosts," said Sam.
"I've heard about these, but I'd no idea there were so many,"
Ramona said as the running crowd grew thicker yet. The man standing by the gate to check tickets said,
"There's been more of them every day this month. They start around midday and tail off around 2 p.m. We've no idea what's causing them."
"Don't they frighten the tourists?"
Jenny asked. The man shrugged.
"Well, a bit. But what can anyone do?"
"Certainly. Some of the real people, coming out of the silver booths, cringed, rather, when they found a crowd of ghosts rushing straight at them. But when they discovered they could walk through them, most of them laughed and seemed to decide that this was one of the sights they had come to see." The kiosk had a loudspeaker going now, muddled a bit by the loudspeaker from the kiosk on the platform across the river, where more frantic time ghosts were also rushing at the time locks.
"Visitors, please pay no attention to the persons apparently running towards the time locks. They are a Time City phenomena known as time ghosts and quite harmless."
A number of the real tourists looked as if they had half a mind to go straight home again until they heard this message. Only one person took no notice of the ghosts at all. He stepped out of a booth and strode forward as if the platform was empty. But he was a time ghost too, Vivian realized. She was beginning to be able to tell. He was wearing old-fashioned-looking clothes, and he had a slight blurring round the edges of him. But the odd thing was that she thought she had seen this particular ghost before somewhere. She tried to follow him as he strode through the crowd of running ghosts and among surprised, slower-moving tourists. But he vanished in the way time ghosts did.
"Let's go," said Jenny. "I really hate time ghosts."
They were all glad to go. The waves of silently rushing figures made them all uncomfortable. It was hard not to feel panicked at the way the ghosts were so desperately beating on the time booths, even when you knew they were not real. They went down the steps to the boat again.
"The lagoon," said Jenny. "We'll tell you when to moor."
The lagoon was a bend of the river that the river had left behind. It had turned into a long, curved lake, with a narrow channel for boats at either end. A filter in the channels kept the water a pure, clean green, so that people could bathe.
"You can swim first or eat first,"
said Jenny, when the boat drew onto a grassy bank.
"But if you eat first, you must wait at least an hour before swimming." "Eat first," they all said.
They were ravenous. The time they had spent in 1939 had stretched the morning nearly 4 hours longer than it should have been. It was as if they had missed lunch. They made up for it now, sitting under flowering bushes on airy rugs that Ramona had brought. They wolfed down long loaves with savoury fillings and round buns with cheesy centres, and they crunched apples. There were butter pies after that, to Sam's loud delight. Then there was an hour to pass. The ladies spent it stretched on a rug in the shade of the bush, talking in low voices.
"Abdul's really worried," Vivian heard Ramona say. "The outbreak of that war has gone back a whole year now to September 1938. They seem to be inventing weapons they shouldn't have till the end of the century." "I wish they'd recall the observers," Jenny said. "Viv could be killed. Don't tell me observers haven't been killed before this. Remember that poor girl who was covering the reconquest of America?"
"Oh, Viv's all right," said Ramona.
"His report was one of the ones that came in this morning.
The new developments seem to have taken him by surprise.
I'm afraid Abdul will keep him out there for a while because he sent straight back to Viv for an explanation. At least Vivian's safe."
Sam fell asleep on his face in the grass. Jonathan wandered off round the lake, jerking his head at Vivian to come along. When Vivian grudgingly followed him, she found him sitting on a fallen tree, looking white and scared.
"We've got to think what to do," he said. "If it really was one of the polarities that boy stole, Time City isn't balanced anymore, and nor is history."
"Do you think he was the Time Lady in disguise?" Vivian said.
"I don't know," said Jonathan. "I don't know who he is or what's going on, but he time-travelled after he took that box, so he has to be a threat to Time City, whoever he is."
"I think we should tell someone," said Vivian. "It's serious."
"But we can't," Jonathan said. "Think. The only way we could have known about that boy and that box is by illegal time-travel to an unstable era. And if we tell them how we happened to find out through your cousin Wartface, it'll come out that you're illegal too. We can't tell. We have to do something ourselves."
"Would it really be so bad? What they'd do to us if they found out?" Vivian asked.
"I don't know what they'd do to you. Could be very bad," Jonathan said. "But I know what they'd do to me. They'd send me out into history.
into a really boring fixed era, and I'd have to stay there, and I can't face that. He was shaking at the mere idea. I've always been afraid I wouldn't qualify to stay when it comes to the leavers tests. I worked and worked at school, and I made a fuss about being a Lee so that I could have Dr. Willander for my tutor, because he's the best there is. And I stuck with him, though he scares me stiff most of the time, because I know I'd go batty in a week somewhere where the lander just goes on and on and on. Vivian knew this was a real confession of Jonathan's true feelings. It was the kind of thing nobody ever said except as a last resort.
But if that really was a polarity, she said, someone who can do something ought to know. And couldn't you drop hints to your father?
No, said Jonathan. He'd wonder how I knew.
Then drop hints to someone else, said Vivian.
They wandered along the lake, arguing about it, for the rest of the hour. Jonathan thought of 100 different reasons why hinting was impossible, but Vivian thought of her own mum and dad out in history, that seemed to have been sent wrong and bad by that beastly thief of a boy, and argued grimly on. In the end, she won. When Jenny appeared on the lakeside, waving what seemed to be a swimsuit and shouting, "Are you going in, you two?" Jonathan set off towards her, saying, "All right, you win. I'll drop Mother a hint."
"Wait a sec," Vivian called after him. "I can't swim. Does it matter?"
Jonathan stopped as if she had shot him. "Oh, no. My cousin Vivian could swim like a fish. She was always ducking me. Mother and Ramona are bound to remember she could."
"Couldn't I have forgotten how?"
Vivian suggested. "Swimming's not a thing people forget. It's like walking or something," Jonathan said. "Look, let me give Mother that hint now. I've got all nerved up to do it. Then we'll think what to do." When they got back to the boat and the picnic, Jonathan looked casually at the sky and remarked, "I've had an idea, Mother, about all that upset in 20th century. Suppose someone there had stolen a Time City polarity. Wouldn't that send history critical around it?" Jenny just laughed and threw a swimsuit over his head.
"Shut up and get into that, you and your ideas, Jonathan."
The swimsuit was large because it covered your whole body and had heaters in it to keep you warm when the water was cold, and it muffled the rest of Jonathan's hint completely. All anyone heard of his reply was, "Oh, but..." When he had fought his way free, he had stopped trying. It was quite easy to disguise the fact that Vivian could not swim, because Jenny and Ramona were busy teaching Sam, and Sam was making a great noise objecting. Jonathan and Vivian just went further down the shore and put some bushes between themselves and Sam's shouts and splashes. There Jonathan did his best to teach Vivian to swim too. She splashed about bravely with Jonathan's hand under her chin, and sank every time he took his hand away. She drank pints of lake. And all the time she knew perfectly well that Jonathan was secretly very glad that Jenny had only laughed at his hint. So every time she came spluttering out of the water, she pulled the water out of her own eyes and looked into Jonathan's, which were strangely naked and folded-looking without his sight function.
"You will try hinting again, won't you?" she said.
"Oh, all right," Jonathan said at last. "If I'd known what a nag you were, I'd have left you with Cousin Wartface. The two of you would have got on wonderfully." He kept his word. When they came back to the Inuit Palace, tired and sun-soaked and feeling very jolly, Jonathan honourably made another attempt to drop a hint during dinner. The guests that night with a high scientist, Dr. Leonov, from Ongoing, a lesser scientist from Erstwhile, and a world premiere and her husband from 8,210. Jonathan waited for a pause in the stately talk and said loudly,
I have a theory that 20th Century is being disturbed because someone there has stolen one of Faber John's polarities. Does anyone think that's possible?
The Premier said,
Do you people really believe in those legends here?
Jenny looked very embarrassed. The Premier turned to Dr. Leonov for an answer, but Dr. Leonov did not deign to reply. He left it to the lesser scientist, who said quite kindly,
Oh, well, no, lad. The forces that interact with history to hold Time City in place are not really of a kind that anyone could steal. And Faber John's only a myth, you know. But suppose the polarity was quite small and buried in the ground or something, Jonathan said bravely. Someone could steal it.
Sempiterne Walker gave him an anguished glare.
Stop talking nonsense, Jonathan. That idiotic notion was disproved in your grandfather's day.
Jonathan stuck his chin in his chest to hide how red his face was and gave up. Vivian could hardly blame him. She knew it had taken a lot of courage for Jonathan to hint at all. And that night in her room, she tried to have a serious think about what they ought to do now. She felt she ought to help Jonathan put the mess right before she went home. But the only idea that came into her head was the thought of Mum sitting in Lewisham with bombs dropping and history going wronger and wronger around her. Chapter 8. Duration. Petula woke Vivian early the next day. She was carrying a studded belt like Jonathan's, but pale and stiff and new.
Elio sent you this, she said. It's school today, so get moving. But do us all a favour and don't wear that yellow and purple horror that Elio likes so much. I can't bear to think of them setting eyes on it in duration.
Vivian chose a plain blue suit and buckled the stiff belt round it. She went downstairs, fingering the studs, wondering which was which and not quite daring to experiment. There seemed to be a lot of activity in the palace. She could hear feet hammering up and down the other staircases and voices calling out.
"What's going on?"
she asked Jonathan when she met him in the hall. But Jonathan only said,
"Hints are no good. Nobody takes any notice. I was awake half the night trying to think what to..."
He had to jump to one side. Sempiterne Walker came bursting out of a door by the stairs and went flying past them down the hall. He was wearing a stiff red robe and a gold-embroidered cloak, but the robe was undone and streaming on both sides of him. Vivian saw a suit of white underclothes underneath and a lot of thin, hairy leg. She stared after him as he dashed away, unable to believe her eyes.
"Gold bands!" Sempiterne Walker roared. "Where in time's name are my gold bands?"
Elio came racing out of the door too, carrying a red silk hat. Jenny rushed out after him with a huge gold necklace like a mare's chain, and after her, Petula came running, followed by the ladies who served at dinner and five other people Vivian had not seen before, and behind them pelted the men who polished the stairs. They were all carrying bundles of robe or hats or golden boots or different sorts of gold chain, and Petula was waving a pair of wide gold ribbons. Vivian watched, fascinated, as they all tore after Sempiterne Walker and managed to corner him at the end of the hall.
"No, you stupid android!"
Sempiterne Walker shouted out in the midst of them.
"The other hat! And I said the gold bands, you stupid woman! Find them, can't you? The ceremony's due in 20 minutes!"
He came bursting out of the crowd and sped towards Jonathan and Vivian again.
"This is marvellous,"
Vivian thought, as the others all turned themselves hastily round and raced after the sempiterne. Sempiterne Walker swung himself nimbly round on the end of the banisters and went flying up the stairs two at a time. "And I have to have the carnelian studs," he bellowed. "Can't anyone find anything in this place?" A giggle began to rise up in Vivian's throat, as everyone else went streaming up the stairs after him. "You're all useless," she heard him shout. "Gold bands." They all went running round the railed landing overhead, tripping over mats and getting in one another's way. Vivian nearly laughed outright. "This is as good as a film," she thought, turning to see what Jonathan thought of it. Jonathan swung haughtily away. "This happens every time there's a ceremony," he said wearily. "Come on, we'd better get breakfast." The giggle was sitting right behind Vivian's teeth, fighting to get out. She swallowed it down.
"Do you have ceremonies very often?"
she asked, trying to stop her voice shaking. "About every 2 days," Jonathan said dourly. They had breakfast, to the din of running feet, shouting, and one or two metallic crashes as if someone had thrown a gold chain downstairs. Jonathan pretended not to notice. Vivian understood perfectly that he would be very hurt if she laughed, but the giggle would keep rising up her throat whenever the running feet and the roars came close to the matutinal. This made it hard for her to follow what Jonathan was saying.
"We ought to go after that boy and get the box back," he said. "If he was doing 100 years with every time jump, he'll be in the middle of a fixed era by now, and probably sending that crazy too. We should be able to find him if that time egg works, but I didn't like the way it nearly didn't bring us back. We don't want to get stranded in history."
The sempiterne's feet pounded past the matutinal, followed by the feet of everyone else. Vivian struggled with a rising giggle again.
"Do you think he might be trying to steal all the polarities?"
she asked, trying to think sensibly.
"Couldn't we go to them first and ask the people in those places to keep guard on them? And how many of them are there?"
"I don't know," Jonathan said, almost groaning. "I don't know where or when they are. I'm not even sure that it was a polarity he stole."
It was clear that what the scientists said last night had shaken Jonathan's faith badly. And he certainly had jumped to that conclusion, Vivian thought. There was no proof. On the other hand... Here, Sempiterne Walker's feet thumped across the ceiling of the matutinal, and she had to swallow the giggle again.
"Do cheer up," she said. "Think of our time ghosts. You can tell we did do something."
"That's true," Jonathan said, brightening a little.
Soon after this, the palace went suddenly quiet. Jonathan pressed the clock stud on his belt and said that they ought to be going. Vivian got up and followed him, feeling very nervous. Jonathan did not seem to be taking anything to school with him, not even a pen. This made Vivian feel odd and incomplete. She thought she had got used to the naked feeling of wearing Time City pyjamas, but she felt naked all over again without any books or even a pencil box. The hall and the stairs were littered with silken cloaks, various hats, shoes, and several golden chains. Elio was soberly backing down the stairs, picking everything up. Vivian could not see his face clearly, but she could have sworn that Elio was smiling. Sam was definitely smiling when they met him by the fountain in Time Close, his widest smile with 2 teeth in it.
Your father ran,
he said,
like a rocket. He picked up his robes and he sprinted. Was it a big fuss?
About average, Jonathan said haughtily. Get moving. It's due to rain in 10 minutes. Vivian looked up at the sky as they came through the archway into Aeon Square. White clouds were billowing up, with grey ones following. But it did not look very much like rain.
Are you sure it's going to rain?
Yes, because we're getting this year's weather from 3589, said Jonathan. They never pick a drought year because of the crops. You can get a forecast from your belt.
Which stud? Said Vivian.
They went across Aeon Square, showing Vivian how her belt worked. The weather stud lit up a shining green list along her forearm. 500 to 840. Fair temperature, 14 to 17.